Test. 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 Testing. Test.
Check this out.
Ranger.
Autonomous Action Radio, a multimedia radio show, a website, an idea, a suggestion, an action plan. Because it's up to us now.
This communique will most likely be marked and destroyed shortly after it is discovered. Listen on at your own risk. The urban industrialized society that you live within is systematically destroying the environment. The Mechanopolis is destroying the planet. You have been psychologically programmed to believe that this is not happening. Pockets of resistance have been weeded out and crushed.
Won't tell you. Your school systems won't teach you. Your scientists will not document it. Your planet is at war. A way of life sustained by mechanized resource pillaging is killing you and everything around you. The machine culture is killing you. You do not believe it is real because you have been indoctrinated. Your base-level understandings of human instinct have been infiltrated and rewired. You have been assimilated. You have been assimilated. You have been assimilated. Fundamental understandings of your humanity have been stripped from you. You exist within a society of product-based resource mongering, and you have been taught to think that this way of life is harmless and acceptable. You are a living organism, meant to be sustained by the living organic land base you exist upon. You are not meant to live in large numbers. You are not meant to live inside concrete. You are not meant to struggle for financial gain. Your planet is at war. Machine culture is killing you. The city you live in has destroyed the organic land base that you were meant to cohabitate. The plants and animals of this planet are under attack. You are an animal. You are an animal. You are under attack. The city you live in is killing you and all the people you love. The society you live within has created distractions of power and pleasure to disarm you. The machines are your enemy. You are being attacked by the machine of large-scale industrial progress. Your planet is at war. The machines are your enemy. Machine. machines. Machine culture is your enemy.
My name is Linda, and I'm here today with Wave. And you just heard from Resident Antihero. I noticed just then that I played Resident Antihero at the beginning of last week's show, and actually at the beginning of every Autonomous Action radio show, which is aired on Z Digital and also as a podcast, is Resident Antihero as well. So I guess it's
bit of a favourite, eh?
It's a bit of a favourite, and I guess it's a bit of a theme, maybe. And the song that I really wanted to play today is called Your Planet Is at War. And the reason why I was thinking of that is that yesterday was the Palm Sunday Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament. And last night, as I was lying, trying to go to sleep, thinking about it, and because it's something like all this talk of peace and no war and everything. But then the thing is that even if there were no wars, there is violence inherent in the system. To quote from Monty Python, the violence inherent in the system, and we're at war with the planet. Even if there was no actual, you know, wars, like a military government's raging war, there is war with the planet. We do not live in harmony with
Mother Earth. So maybe it's inherent Mother in Earth. People, in us?
I don't think so, because there are examples of people that live... Yeah. That live in harmony with the planet. So it's not really inherent in people, it's inherent in civilization.
Certain things bring it out of us.
And, yeah, that is kind of what is mentioned in the film Endgame, which I helped Franklin Lopez with the tour last year of the film End Civ. And one of the premises in the book Endgame, which is by Derek Jensen, one of the premises is that civilization is based on violence, and even if there's no violence between nations, there's violence. That one of the examples is that if you don't pay your rent, then someone's gonna if you don't pay your rent, then someone's gonna come around, and you know, it'll get to be violent. That there's gonna be violence, and that's the whole system. And so when we look at the Palm Sunday Rally for Peace, it's not just it shouldn't be just about no war, but also looking at our society and reconfigurating the whole society.
As in, no, against violence in general.
Well, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, because it's not just about war being violent. There's lots of violence otherwise, which is not peace.
And also not always... you know, kind of subtler or psychological violence and stuff like that, then you get to as well.
Yeah, perhaps not as overt violence, yeah. but it's still there, hidden in the system. So we're going to be hearing today from some of the speakers from the Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament. But Wave, you've got a bit of the history of the Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament.
Oh yeah, I did a little reading up this morning about it. That it does come from an anti-nuclear kind of heritage, basically. Which, just to go back a little bit further, you know, there was a bit of ban the bomb stuff in 1964. In the hippie days. Oh, and actually, the political hippies, that's what yippies are. Yippies are the political hippies. So there you go. And then came to a head in Australia when it was against the French nuclear testing that was going on in the Pacific atolls like Mururoa. So people were up in arms about that then. And it created such a tension that an international court of justice stopped that going on. And so then this nuclear attention came to focus on mining, and groups like Friends of the Earth came to Australia to do that. And there were some rallies throughout the cities, 7,000 people in late 1976, and up to 50,000, Jim Green's history says as well, in protest of uranium mining and such like that, so that the ALP National Conference passed an indefinite moratorium in 1977. This is while they were in opposition. But then, of course, once just pre the election in 1983, where Hawke and that came to power in 1982, they'd reverted that to a one-mine policy, and then after they got to power, it became a three-mine policy. And even in 84, they started selling to France again as well, which led to the resignation of many ALP left people. So, But in that anti-period, when ALP was in opposition, there was a lot of anti-nuclear stuff which basically backed ALP. And so in 1982, they had the first Palm Sunday rallies in Australia, in the biggest cities, where 100,000 people came out to protest against, anti-nuclear and peace and disarmament, and also anti-US bases and visits from US warships, because they were all nuclear-powered. And by 1985, there were 350,000 people at these Palm Sunday rallies. But 1986, it fell off 200,000, and it kind of petered off since then. Basically because, as Jim Green put it, the ALP leadership became more adept at co-opting the social movements, including the anti-nuclear and environment movements. So basically because things were a little bit kind of covered by the Labor, or things seemed to be a bit of a win for the nuclear movement, so the kind of protest movement stuff washed out a bit and just became about petitions and stuff like that, and the kind of need to get on the streets and march kind of dissipated, and so led to the decline in that whole anti-movement, and so it's just been kind of petering along since then. And so yesterday there were, well, they reckon there were a few more than last year, but perhaps 50 to 100 people kind of gathered around listening to speakers.
Yep, in Brisbane, the Rally for Peace has been run by Joan Shears for, I'd say it's almost the amount of time that it's been happening.
Since 1982, perhaps.
So this is, and I think it was the 32nd rally this year, which would mean that it started in 1980, if I'm right. I'm trying to do maths and think about my own age and do that. So
81, maybe.
Yeah. In Brisbane, it's being run by Joan Shears. And this year was the same. I remember ever since I was a kid that my parents used to take me along. And so I remember Joan Shears from way back then. But also this year, Robin Taubenfeld and Greg Brown helped out Joan Shears a lot. She was telling me yesterday she couldn't have done it without them. And we've got an interview with Greg Brown talking about the issue of amplification. You may have heard that the Brisbane City Council bylaws forbid amplification, and so that they were going to have, they said that there would be no amplification, but there was a bit of lobbying, etc., and the amplification did go ahead. But before we listen to Greg Brown, I'm going to go to a song. This is We Are Angela Pamela by the Super Raylene Brothers.
Rana umenda ngobai. Kuya kuya ndia kungura. Kuya kuya ndia kwa rafi. Kapi kuya ni.
Rangwa. Leave it. Want it, Angela Pamela. It's rubbish, don't dig it. Ninda, sick and dora. We are, bitcha, lawa, uranium, nothing.
Uranium, all by all, Burunga, Jarba, bye.
Leave it,
Yana, Omeida, goodbye. We are, Kapi
Guyani. Minda Sikandora. Ria Picha Lawa. Uranium nothing. Rangwa.
Really dare. Minda. Wanti.
Angela Pamela.
It's
rubbish.
Iti kwati nuna kone.
Don't dig it. Minda Sikandora.
Yana ngomain dan gubai, wea koyan jago ngura, wea koyan jago halat prenginja, kapi koyan. Uranium world bayul berunga, dar babai.
Wea, itcha, lawa, uranium nothing, rangwa, leave it, wanti. Angela Pamela, it's rubbish, don't dig it. Minda, sick and dora. We are itcha Laua Uranium nothing.
And that was We Are Angela Pamela by the Super Raylean Brothers, and that's Aboriginal language, We Are, which means stop. We're going to listen to an interview I did with Greg Brown yesterday. He's from the Rally for Nuclear Peace and Nuclear Disarmament, and he also is a lawyer, so he has a good idea of what he's talking about here.
Joan Shears, who's the organiser for the rally, put in an application for peaceful assembly. That's to have the rally, the regular Palm Sunday peace rally in Radcliffe Place. And the council got back to us, and they advised us that amplification was banned, that there was a ban on the use of amplification in relation to peaceful assemblies in the Queen Street Mall, and that includes Radcliffe Place.
And did you know how long this ban's been in place?
The bans have been in place for some time now. There are council bylaws which prohibit a whole range of political activities in the Queen Street Mall. So it's not just amplification, but it also includes things like the distribution of leaflets or printed material, public speaking generally, the setting up of information stalls, and that kind of thing. So there's a range of political activities. If you're thinking about campaigning around a particular issue, whether that's gay rights or Aboriginal rights or union rights or any such thing, those kind of activities are generally prohibited in accordance with the Brisbane City Council bylaws, as they are in most other cities around Australia.
So how did you get to have the rally today with amplification?
Well, we indicated to council that the rally was going to proceed with the use of amplification. We believe that we had the right to do that under the Peaceful Assembly Act. What we did was we got word out to quite a few people through different organisations, through the trade unions, and using social media to let people know that the council was trying to restrict civil liberties. A lot of people expressed concern about what the council was trying to do, and a lot of people expressed concern that that they would want to do something in response to the council's attempted ban. I think if the council had proceeded with the ban on amplification, a lot more people would have turned out to today's quite successful rally because of the civil liberties aspect.
Did you talk to the council to get them to change around, or do you think other people talked to the council?
I'm sure other people let the council know of their point, of their attitude and their concern to defend freedom of speech in Brisbane. I did talk to the council as well on Wednesday last week, and I just I gave them a call to find out whether they wanted to enter into mediation under the provisions of the Peaceful Assembly Act, and that is because there were the unresolved issues. Council were until that stage apparently insistent on the ban on amplification. And of course, we wanted to proceed. We wanted to see the rally proceed with the use of PA equipment and so on. So we were happy to sit down and talk to them about that and to see if we could work through the issues. They contacted their legal unit, and when we spoke to the City Council later on in the afternoon, they advised us that they were going to remove the restrictions on the rally and that the rally could proceed. So I think what comes out of the whole episode with the Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament protest today is quite an important lesson for political activists generally in Brisbane and Queensland, and that is that if the council is pushing you around and denying you basic democratic rights such as the right to give people leaflets or printed material in public spaces or use amplification or to exercise your freedom of speech, you need to take a stand. Seek legal opinion if you're unsure of how the provisions of the Peaceful Assembly Act work. Take a stand, and you need to do that in order to ensure that that those important democratic rights aren't taken away from us.
So basically, you used a state act to do the rally today, not a local council act.
Mm. That's right. There are those kind of political activities are prohibited under the bylaws, under the City Council bylaws, and that includes things like public speaking, use of amplification, distribution of printed material and so on in public spaces. Now, that's prohibited under the Brisbane City Council bylaws, as it is by the bylaws of most cities and towns and local governments around Australia. We did rely upon the provisions of the Peaceful Assembly Act to push back against that, and we think that we had a good case for that. There is a little bit of uncertainty in that particular area of law because there was a High Court decision handed down on the 27th of February, and that was an appeal by the South Australian Attorney General, and the other party was the City Council of Adelaide. The City Council of Adelaide, in that particular case, had attempted to stop Christians from speaking in public spaces and handing out printed material. That case was taken all the way to the High Court. Unfortunately, the High Court handed down what I think is arguably a very poor decision, at least poor from the point of view of democratic rights and particularly freedom of speech, in that the court found that the bylaws that had been put in place by the City of Adelaide prohibiting those kinds of political activities without permission were constitutionally valid and did not infringe the implied constitutional right for political communication. So it's quite a regrettable decision. It's a decision that adds a little bit of uncertainty to the law in Queensland. It's quite a significant setback for freedom of speech in states where there is no legislation equivalent to the Peaceful Assembly Act. So in Queensland, we're fortunate to have that legislation that we can use to rely on and use to safeguard. It offers some protections for basic democratic rights. There are no such statutory safeguards in a lot of other states. So that means that in Adelaide, for example, particularly, but also in other major cities around Australia, that if you want to hand out leaflets or set up a soapbox to talk about an issue, a political issue that's important to you, you don't have that right unless you get the permission of the City Council. I think the problems are quite obvious. If you're wanting to campaign against the local government or against the political party, maybe the party that's formed state government, particularly if that happens to be also the party that controls the local council, then you're going to run into opposition in terms of getting that permission from the council. So the High Court decision is a significant setback for freedom of speech in Australia.
I can see the Labour Party coming to power in the next election. Maybe, maybe not, who knows? But it doesn't really make any difference who's in power. The state remains the same. The structure's still there. They just tinker a little bit of it here and there. But it doesn't really make any difference who's in power. The state remains the same. The structure's still there. They just tinker a little bit of it here and there.
Tune in to Autonomous Action Radio, 4ZZZ's Anarchy Show. every Monday from 12 to 1 p.m. on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM or streaming at 4ZZZFM.org.au. You're listening to Autonomous Action Radio, and we're today recapping on the Palm Sunday Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament, which was held in Brisbane and around Australia on March the 24th. And now we're going to hear from Donna Mulhern,
who is quite an accomplished peace activist. She used to be a journalist and a political advisor, but she's also been involved as a human shield against the Iraq war, and she's also spent time in the West Bank of Palestine as a volunteer for the International Solidarity Movement. She's been involved with actions here, like the action where a bunch of people got into Pine Gap, the US spy base in the Northern Territory. She is a Christian, but we didn't include any of that Christian stuff. Wave wanted to say something about the Old Testament.
Well, it's on Palm Sunday, and they use the rainbow and the dove, which is a reference to the new promise from the flood, from the ark, Noah and the flood, and all that. You know, it's a story that's in various cultures, so it's probably, you know, pretty universal kind of old thing of, you know, new hope and stuff like that. Blah 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 blah.
Going about the country, talking to people, visited five or six different cities, listening to people's stories, walking down the streets, sitting in the tea shops, the coffee shops, family homes. But one of the most terrifying experiences that I had is connected to this philosophy that our governments have, and that is that I was invited by the Australian Embassy to come to visit for a cup of tea, and I thought, oh, this is okay, I can tell the Australian Embassy what I'm thinking about the situation, etc. And so the Australian Embassy asked me, how are you going to get there? Can your driver give us his ID and all the rest? And just let me explain that the Australian Embassy is in a place called the Green Zone, which is also called the International Zone. But in Baghdad, it's like another country. So it's Saddam's palace complex, and it's huge. It's like the Vatican, but bigger. So it's like a city-state surrounded by concrete and razor wire, and no ordinary person is allowed in. And no, the foreigners who live and work in there don't go out. And so they asked me, how are you going to get here? And I said, well, I'll do what I always do, is catch a taxi and meet you out the front. And they thought I was joking. I couldn't believe I would say that. But they said, well, actually, that's not going to work for us. So they said, we'll send someone to pick you up. So they sent one first guy who was their security guy. He came to my hotel after he'd been there the whole morning, he said, checking the security, doing a recce. He picked me up in his car, then he took me about three blocks away, where I had to get out of that car and run to another car, which are a three-car security detail. So these were huge, big gold cars with massive, big antennas and spirals on the roof. And in each car, so there were three, I was asked to run and to get into the centre car. In each car, there were two big, burly, huge, they were all British, former SAS soldiers carrying machine guns. And I was bundled into the back of one of these cars and said, excuse me, miss, you can choose if you want to put on the bulletproof jacket or not. And I thought he was joking, went, ha ha, that's a good one. And he said, no, you can choose if you would like to put it on or not. You know, this is a dangerous place. You know, this is high security. You know, you can't risk your life. I didn't have the heart to tell him. I'd just been walking alone down the main street of Baghdad hailing taxis. Didn't have the heart to tell him that. I declined the bulletproof vest. Drove through the streets of Baghdad in the security detail, and I'd never felt more terrified. And that is because the act of that was separating and isolating itself from the Iraqi people. And it was advertising, there's a foreigner in here, she may be important, you know? And I went into the green zone, and it was scary, it was eerie, it was bizarre, it was offensive. This city-state where all these foreigners live, who basically run the policy in Iraq for their countries, and yet they do it. So, for example, run the policy for health without visiting a hospital. Run or give advice on the policy for education without ever going to a school. Never actually living. And I was appalled to hear a phrase that I heard back in 2004 when I had a similar experience. And that was one of the staff in the Australian Embassy referred to where I'd been. They said, where's your hotel? I explained where it was, just downtown near the National Theatre. He said, oh, in the red zone. I said, the red zone? Back in 2004, when I first heard that phrase, I didn't know what they meant. I said, what do you mean? Back then I said, by the red zone. And someone said, oh, the red zone is everything outside of the green zone. So what they had done was designated an entire country in one military category as unsafe. You know, red alert, you are in constant danger. And I couldn't believe, I was so shocked that 10 years later, staff of the Australian Embassy were still referring to the country of Iraq that contains human beings, mums and dads, kids at school, normal people, has still been disregarded in this little category of the red zone. Do you know what? When you hold a machine gun and wear a bulletproof vest and drive around like that, everyone you see is an enemy. When you hold a gun, everyone is a danger. Everything is a danger. You see something move, it's a danger. And that's how their attitude was. And that's been a consistent attitude in the 10 years of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. A total disconnection by the Western invading forces, a total disconnection with the Iraqi people. Never did it occur to them early on to consult with the Iraqi people about the way forward. Instead, this guy named Paul Bremer, who's been on the radio this week. I couldn't believe that any media think that this guy, Paul Bremer, who was the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, would have any right or authority to speak about Iraq. That guy has destroyed the place. And yet he's on the radio. Why? Because he's an important man and he's an authority figure. And then this week I also woke up to Major General Jim Molan, an Australian soldier, former general. And he's on the radio as well because he served in Iraq. And so they thought he's important because he's got shiny buttons and a nice pressed coat and he's got a title. And so they should interview him as well. And as I think I told you the other night, I heard him on Fran Kelly, almost, you know, lost my breakfast as I heard him. And so I ran Fran Kelly's program to say, how can you have that man talk about Iraq when he wasn't actually there? Oh, they said he served for a year. I said he lived in the green zone, which meant he never walked down a street of an Iraqi town. He never spoke to ordinary Iraqis. He drove in tanks and he bombed the place. Of course, we know Major General Jim Molan's role in Iraq in 2004 was to plan and implement the attacks on the city of Fallujah. And many of you know what resulted from those attacks in April and November 2004. We know that chemical weapons were used, possibly weapons containing depleted uranium, and the legacy of those attacks will be long-term. An Australian was involved in organising that. And all the more the reason why, I'll come back to this in the end, we need an inquiry into Australia's involvement in the Iraq War, and we need it now. How could it be that 10 years ago, we went to a war with a country in which we had no conflict with and knew nothing about, on the decision of one man, John Howard, without a debate in Australia's parliament? We are meant to be a democracy. We are meant to be a vibrant democracy, Australia. And yet our members, our representatives, had no opportunity before our troops went to war to debate and discuss that in Australia's parliament. It's barely believable. That's extraordinary that could happen in a modern democracy. So what do we see in Iraq today? What we see in Iraq today is a failed, dysfunctional state. What we see in Iraq today is a government installed which did not receive the highest number of votes at the last election, because of what you'll hear a lot of the politicians say in the next couple of weeks and this week is, yeah, but at least the Iraqis have a democracy. Oh, look, they've gone through a hard time the last 10 years, but at least they have a democracy. You say that to an Iraqi person in Iraq and their response will be bewilderment and a bit of a laugh. They say, like, are you kidding? Don't you know what happened in 2010? And I don't think most Australians do know what happened in 2010, the last Iraqi elections, because Iraq has gone off the radar. What happened? Well, there was an election, there was one group of coalition who received the highest number of votes, and then there was wheeling and dealing and backroom deals and the US influence and the influence from Iran, and then another coalition was installed. Now, that's not the definition of a democracy, and Iraqis aren't stupid and they know that. And so they just dismiss with bitterness any suggestion that Iraq has a democracy, because clearly they don't, just by the technical definition. Then they say, well, at least you don't have Saddam, at least you don't have the human rights abuses. Well, okay, let's talk about that. Iraq today, you probably haven't heard, because it's not in the media, about 500,000 Iraqis come out every week in massive demonstrations all over the country to protest against the human rights violations of the Iraqi government. I'll just summarise them. There's, of course, major discrimination against one part of the community where you can't even get a job, you can't get your pension if you worked in the public service for 30 years, etc., etc. You have no opportunity in the future. This is a segregation, a discrimination, a form of apartheid, really. So there's that. There's also the fact there's about 5,000 Iraqis in prison right now as we speak who have not been charged with anything. This is related to the you think our anti-terror laws are bad. Iraq also has anti-terror laws in which you can have arbitrary arrest and imprisonment without charge or trial. So the average time of imprisonment for Iraqis who are in prison now is about 3 years without a charge or a trial. Another terrible thing that's happening is that when there's a suspect and the army or the police will go to the house to arrest a man, if the man is not at home, they will arrest his sister or his wife and put her into prison. So we now have about 500 women in Iraqi prisons who have not been charged with anything. I don't know about you, but this isn't sounding great. Actually, the Iraq of today is so bad, according to Iraqis, and personally, that's the view I trust, rather than John Howard and Jim Molan. So what have the Iraqis judged? Well, about 3 million of them have judged with their feet, and they have decided that the new Iraq is so awful to live in, so unsafe, so offensive to them, you know, now a religious theocracy run by clerics and mullahs, human rights violations, etc., etc., so bad that they've chosen to live, instead of living there, in squalor and in poverty as refugees, than to live in the new Iraq, living as refugees in neighbouring Jordan or Syria and trying to find a third country for resettlement. That's their judgment, as I said, and that's the opinion that I value. Of course, in Iraq, as well as that political violence, the political thuggery, every political party having their own personal death squad, Iraqis feeling as if they can't walk out of their home in the morning with fear of making it home, you know, they fear they won't make it home alive, afraid to send their children to school. The level of violence is increasing from the terrible years of the political violence from 2006 to 2009, of where it was about 2,000 to 3,000 people killed in a month. For the Iraqis, this war never ended. It never ended. It's just gone off the radar. Now, I'm not sure if you heard, just in the last 10 days, there's been 4 major bombings and about 200 people killed. The average now is about 300 to 400 a month. Again, this is the new Iraq that John Howard and his friends say, but it's going well, and isn't it fantastic? I heard the Australian ambassador to Iraq speak at a conference last week, and I was appalled to hear her say how she thought everything was going well. Well, from the Green Zone, everything is going well. But she's predicted that soon Australia's aid contribution to Iraq will be cut. It will be reduced because the oil revenues are increasing. Mind you, the oil revenues might never make it. Do you know, slums did not exist in Iraq before 2003. There was hardship because of the sanctions imposed on the country, but Iraq was never a third world country. Now there are slums that you would see in Asia and India with open sewers. Poverty, because these are internally displaced people displaced by war and violence who now have nowhere to live. Women, mostly. Widows. Women and children, always the greatest victims of war, especially in Iraq. So we have an Iraq with major physical challenges, the poverty, the dislocation, and also one of the major legacies which some of these photos refer to, and that is the toxic legacy left by our armies beginning back in 1991, repeated in 2003 despite knowing the impact, and 2004, and that is the use of chemical weapons, weapons containing white phosphorus and weapons containing depleted uranium. I spent time in Basra and in Fallujah, where I walked through children's wards of a cancer hospital in Basra, where the wards were overflowing with children who were dying, about to die. This is a long time onwards from 1991, and the problem is not going to go away. Even though we don't hear about it so much, the problem is only getting worse.
When I was just 16 years old and Elvis Presley rocked and rolled, I never gave a thought to nuclear power. About 150 miles from me in England, across the Irish Sea, an accident grew closer by the hour. Back then they called the place Windscale. The experts said it could not fail. It was always going to make safe nuclear power. One day the cooling system crashed, and deep in the core a fire flashed, and radiation billowed from its towers. And they sealed the plant with concrete, and they took it off the grid, and the numbers of the casualties was covered up and hid. And they said it shouldn't happen, that it wouldn't ever happen. Yes, they said it couldn't happen, but it did. Da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da. Then came the Three Mile Island thing in 79 in the early spring. A fault made radiation levels soar. And no one knows how far or where that poison went in the pleasant air. A secret covered up forevermore. Then nuclear accidents went global. A fatal meltdown at Chernobyl. Radiation spewing far and wide. 100,000 folk from there were made to move and live elsewhere, and officials say 5,000 people died. And they sealed the plant with concrete, though the poison went worldwide, and the victims ate contaminated food and later died. But they said it shouldn't happen, that it wouldn't ever happen. Yes, they said it couldn't happen, but they lied.
And you just heard from Donna Mulhern. You just heard a bit of singing there from Dorgan. And then before that, you heard from Donna Mulhern.
And now we're going to hear from Scott Reichen, who's an organiser at the Electrical Trades Union.
In about 2010, the ETU took a decision. It was by our state council, which is the governing body of the union, which is made up by rank and file union members. It sets the overarching position of the union. And that decision was to make it an offence under our rules for any of our members to work in a uranium mine or further work in a nuclear power plant. The result of that, it wasn't necessarily... We thought it was pretty cool. The result of that was it was not necessarily universally endorsed by or taken on by our members. And at the moment, we've got members in Uranger, or had members in at the Ranger mine in the Northern Territory. Some of them became educated and they got out of there. Some of them left the union because they were more interested in the money. But if you have a look at our DVD, when you go through it, we've got a number of scientists and Dr. Helen Caldicott on there, and I think she sums it up best, that there is no safe level of exposure to radiation. When you work in a uranium mine, you get a little thing, it tells you that you're being infected by radiation. It knows because you're already cognitive. And if you get out of there in a certain amount of time, current theory is that you'll be okay and it's all right. But the reality is there is no safe level of radiation. If we can't have our members working in that environment, how do we send officials into that environment knowingly into a dangerous environment to represent our members? The decision was taken by the union that we can't do that. We can't do it to our employees like myself. We can't do it to our members. We can't do it, let it go on the rest of society without making people aware of what it is. This will be the asbestos of our generation. There is no question, it takes a long time to come on, same as asbestos-related disease. It is insidious, you can't see it happening, same as what happened with the asbestos-related disease. And I think it is a time bomb that's just waiting. There's only one safe way that we can deal with it, and that's to leave it in the ground. And that's the position of the ETU, that's the position of a few other unions that we've taken with us. I encourage you to grab the report. The report highlights the important aspects of everything that's related to uranium mining. It goes to the value. Robin mentioned at the start that last financial year there was $600 million that it brought in to Australia. To put that in context, iron ore brought in $62 billion. Coal was $47 billion. And uranium is $600 million. Campbell Newman's come out in this whole process and said that the government stands to make $900 million out of royalties out of uranium mines in Queensland. Well, given that one year, the entire industry for the entire rest of the country generated $600 million for those companies, not for the government, how it's going to be the half-life of uranium before you accrues $900 million. So it's all a farce, and we're not going to stand by and see it happen in Queensland. We'll take on the government. I implore everyone here, this has to be a community campaign. The communities are the ones that are going to be damaged by this. communities are the ones that are going to have to deal with the ongoing effects of the tailings. Next time we have red dust blow over our cities and we think, oh, it's all very eerie being nighttime in the afternoon, just think of the amount of borium, because that dust blows off the tailing stacks in from the Beverley mine in South Australia. Blows all the way across the country. They test it for uranium, and what do you know? There's no uranium. Well, that's what they're there to mine. What they don't test it for is radioactivity and radioactive borium and the other things that are found in the ground next to the uranium. They extract the uranium, put the tailings in a big pile or in a pool, and then leave the rest of our community to deal with it. Just so that the rest of our community dealing with it. The Ranger Mine, Beverley Mine, they've got contracts that they will deal with the tailings for 10,000 years. And that's not because that's only how short it's going to be dangerous for. It's because that was the best that we could drag a contract out of them for. It's the entire uranium industry in Australia, we've got no more than about 100 years worth of uranium that we can dig out of the ground, and then we're going to be storing it and dealing with the problem for 10,000 years, just those companies. Then it's up to us and our obviously our descendants to deal with the fallout. There's only one safe place for it, that's in the ground. We are going to be part of the community campaign strongly opposing this, and what we need to do is go back to all of our communities, go back to our barbecues and our families and everybody that we talk to, and make it an issue, make people understand what it is. Grab a copy of the report. The report is deals with every single argument that can be put up. Get knowledgeable, go and talk to our families and people, and we have to knock this off in our state. We have to knock it off across the country. But the ETU will be there from the forefront taking this issue on. So thanks for having me today, and I'll leave it at that. Cheers.
And finally on today's show, where we've been hearing about the Rally for Peace and Nuclear Disarmament, we're going to hear from Frederica Stein, a refugee advocate.
At this peace rally, we have heard about wars, going to war unnecessarily. We have heard about the damage that war does, not just to the civilians or to the infrastructure, but to future generations. As we speak, as we sit here, as we enjoy this lovely day, there are 16,500 human beings, most of whom have fled persecution and war zones. They are captives in Australian immigration detention, whether that be on Nauru or Manus Island or Christmas Island or Darwin or any of the mainland detention centres, or living in the community, or on bridging visas in our community without the right to work. These are people in a limbo, not able to get on with their own lives. Most Queenslanders are not aware that we have a detention centre near the airport called Pinkenba. It has a capacity of just over 70 people, and at the moment there are women, men and children in that detention centre. Most of them here because they have medical needs and need access to health services. In a place called Shurga, an Air Force base, 40 kilometers, more than 40 minutes drive, four-wheel drive, outside Weipa, the major towns associated with the largest bauxite mine in the world, is a detention center. It has a capacity of over 600 places, some of them living in tents. You haven't heard about this. Our media doesn't tell us about this. Please focus in this call, this rally about peace, on the human beings who want freedom and peace more than anything else. And consider that our so-called border protection has no business putting up barriers to people who are fleeing persecution. And I don't mean just nasty words. Persecution usually takes the form in Afghanistan and Pakistan of drive-by shootings, kidnappings, assassinations, and bombs in marketplaces near schools. That is what people are fleeing from. That is the people who are targeted by their enemies and who must flee or die. 16,500 people in the so-called care of the Commonwealth of Australia. It shames us all. Here in Brisbane, we have a number of agencies that are doing their darndest to take some of the pain, some of the suffering out of being in limbo. If you are interested in helping with the bridging visa holders who since the 13th of August are not allowed to work, to support themselves, to save money, to send back to their wives and children wherever they may be, usually in danger. We have hit the absolute rock bottom in terms of further punishing and tormenting people who are fleeing war, the absence of peace in their homelands, in their places. The Red Cross plays a part in our town, as does the Multicultural Development Association, the Romero Centre, and Dunlogan Access. All of them are now involved in helping people coming out of detention for a snapshot of 6 weeks of help before those people are on their own. Never has it been more important for decent Australians who can to help them survive this torment of not being allowed to work, of waiting until a public servant somewhere finalises their claim for asylum. And let me be clear, the people who dare to come by boat are the people who are being detained in detention centres and punished without work rights. 99% of the Hazaras and the Tamils turn out to be refugees, people who meet the UN Convention as persons who are persecuted and who cannot, for fear and likelihood of that persecution, go back to where they came from. They are genuine in their wish to find a safe country, to be reunited with the wives and the children who could not come on that dangerous journey precisely because it was dangerous and also because they're exploiting people who make that so costly. People of Brisbane, act, act. Make your views known to your local politician. Our asylum policy has hit rock bottom. It is anti-refugee, it is anti-human rights, it is anti-family in the most horrible way. If you have the time, become active. If you have the space, a spare room in your house, consider having an asylum seeker live in your house, helping them to survive this period while they are waiting for a decision. And we know that as part of the deterrence policy, deterring asylum seekers from finding safety, this process of assessing their claims may spin out to be very long indeed. And that is cruel, it is unnecessary, and I would say it is not Australian in the sense that I learnt as the immigrant child who came to Australia in 1950.
You're listening to Autonomous Action Radio on Z Digital. For more information about the show, you can go to autonomousactionradio.com or 4ZZZFM.org.au. I mix music from Jandy Rainbow, Unisonic Ascension.com underneath today's speakers.
When you feel like you've lost all your hope, when there's no one to help you find where to go. Don't have to look far, you know where I am. I'm waiting at the end of the road. Waiting at the end of the road. We're traveling, don't feel alone. No matter how far you are from your home. Cause when you look up ahead, you'll know where I am. I'm waiting at the end of the road. Waiting at the end of the road. And the places I go and the songs that I sing, the rules that I break and the people I meet. I've got a name, one you can repeat. But I'm waiting at the end of the road. Waiting at the end of the road. I'll try just about anything to make you turn back and be their machine. They'll shackle your feet and they'll shackle your dreams. They say you're as free as can be. Say you're as free as can be. The losses don't take one more step on the road to a place where ideas are not set. But I say run and leave it all behind. Run till there's no running left. Run till there's no running left. And whatever you think and whatever you want, whatever you need and whatever you've got, you've got a right to be who you are. And don't let them take it away. Yeah, don't let them take you away.
Spirit, but I'm still alive.